Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but...
Oh, yeah, we started to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger, the legend Pete Seeger, and David Burns, who wrote the words to that song, except for the word Solartopia, which I wrote to describe a green-powered Earth, which we're going to have real, real soon if we're going to survive as a species. And every day that we have Donald Trump in the White House, it looks tougher and tougher. Thank you, Jesse and the crew in New York, for engineering this show. We are going to have a two-part show. The first quarter hour, we're going to deal with the great Mark Carlin, publisher, editor extraordinaire of BugsFlash.com. Mark, are you with us?
Yes, I am. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. I want to thank you for publishing that bizarre but hilarious satire by the so-called Mark Twain on the brand-new Trump-Cheney cure for the coronavirus. Folks, you'll have to go to BuzzFlash.com and read Tom Paine's report on what Dick Cheney and Donald Trump have in store for America as the bleach waterboarding cure for the coronavirus. Take a look at BuzzFlash.com. We're also joined by Joel Siegel. Joel, are you with us?
Hi, Hawk. Good to be with you today. Okay. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. And after the quarter hour with Mark Carlin, we're going to talk to you and Mark Jacobson about this horrendous, horrific new film this attacking renewable energy. It's really something else. And you, who worked with Michael Moore, who executive produced the thing, are going to have a lot to say about it. And Mark Jacobson will join us from Stanford, one of the world's leading experts in renewable energy. That'll be the second three quarters of the hour. But periodically, in a regular basis, we're joined by Mark Carlin at the top of the hour for his commentary. And Mark, you're going to talk to us about Trump's meat, let's put it that way. So you write beautiful columns at BuzzFlash, and let's hear about your latest.
What Trump did last night was done under the cover of darkness to try to diminish news coverage of what he did. And what he did is another step in what is called calling the herd, which is basically that he is going to let the coronavirus run wild and those who die, and that's an acceptable loss to enrich his corporate crony friends. Very specifically, the meatpacking industry, which consumers generally don't think about or see, has already had more than 5,000, that's 5,000 workers infected. I believe it's 22 or 24 have died. Many of the plants prior to yesterday were shut down because of the coronavirus outbreak. There was a plant in Sioux City, Iowa, where more than 600 of the workers were infected, and the right-wing Republican governor wouldn't close it down. So what Trump did, because the head of Tyson Chickens, which is a huge corporate slaughterer of chickens and other meat, had an advertisement in the New York Times last week that said the food supply chain is going to break down. So Trump what he did is very chilling, and there should be much more outrage than there is about it. But because he released it, as I said, under the cover of darkness, the media didn't pay close attention. And there are several issues that represent how the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, and the Senate Republicans in particular, are willing to literally sacrifice the lives of low-wage earners and middle-class earners in order to, quote-unquote, reopen the economy. So he did several things which represent tools to achieve this end, that we can take a hit of maybe 100, 150,000, 200,000 lives. It's over 60,000 now lost to coronavirus, and that's considered widely as an undercount. The true figure may be about 80, 90,000 who have already been lost to coronavirus. So what Trump did was number one, and this has been widely overlooked, some media has reported on it, was he guaranteed that the companies who in general practice unsafe conditions for the transmission of the coronavirus would not have any liability for a worker to prove that they were infected on the job. This is a tremendous gift to corporations that we don't give, that Trump wouldn't give to average people. It means they can't be sued for unsafe working conditions. Now, the second thing is that OSHA, which is under the Department of Labor, and Eugene Scalia, who's the son of Antonin Scalia, is the Secretary of Labor. OSHA promised to the meat processors that they wouldn't enforce their guidelines for trying to prevent transmission of the coronavirus. So this lets the companies off the hook, and the reason, well, there are several reasons the transmission is so high in the meat packing houses, but they basically don't have to worry that OSHA is going to come in and force them to comply with safe conditions. In addition, the Center for Disease Control changed its recommendations 2 weeks ago so that you don't get time off if you've been exposed to someone with the coronavirus. You can go back and your employer can demand as a working condition that you go back to work. You don't go through a 14-day quarantine. You don't need to be tested for COVID-19. All that the company has to do is take your temperature and then kind of ask you to self-check if you're coughing or coming down with the chills. Then they might give you some time off. But again, normally the CDC guidelines are that if someone is exposed to a person who is infected with the coronavirus, they have to take 14 days off. So the meatpacking companies can't compel a worker to come back even if they've been exposed. And given the number of infected people in the meatpacking industry, this is about the only way they can function, because they really shouldn't be open. And about, I think, a third of the plants had closed down prior to the executive order last night, which, by the way, invoked the Defense Production Act, which Trump would not invoke to get more ventilators and PPEs. it's really only the second time he's invoked it. And he invoked it on behalf of his corporate crony colleagues. In addition, and this sounds like a lot of points, but it shows you how determined the Trump administration is to basically send people to their potential deaths. This additional point is that, and the governor of Iowa stated this publicly, what the executive order mandates is that if a worker now, because these workplaces are officially told to be open due to the Defense Production Act, just as we did in World War II, if a worker doesn't come into work because they feel that the meatpacking environment is a petri dish for coronavirus transmission, which it is, then they can collect workers' unemployment compensation. So Trump is putting the workers in the position that the voters in the Wisconsin primary were put in, which was, in their case, if they wanted to vote, they had a risk infection. And by the way, just as a slight digression, Harvey, the number of people who were infected at that early April primary in Wisconsin are now up to 52. So the Republicans are responsible, and there'll probably be a death or two out of that, for willful manslaughter and forcing people to vote in person in the Wisconsin primary. Now, what Trump has done by not allowing a person to collect unemployment insurance because their workplace is unsafe and fosters transmission of coronavirus is to choose between starving and possibly risking their lives.
Well, here's another question, Mark. Mark Carlin, editor, publisher of, and founder of BuzzFlash.com. Look for his article at BuzzFlash.com and look for the satire by Thomas Paine. Here's a question, and we're going to have to move on to the Michael Moore movie, but is the meat itself carrying the coronavirus?
Now, that's an interesting question. I was listening to Tom Hartman today, and someone called in. Tom didn't know the answer. I tried to do some research on it, and I think in general that's unlikely. I don't want anyone to sue me for saying that, but from what I could read, just because the virus has a life of maybe 3 days or 2 or 3 days, depending upon what it is living off of, or could be on a shelf or plastic. So I don't think by the time the meat gets to the grocery store that it would be carrying the coronavirus. There are many reasons that these are petri dishes for coronavirus, but the main reason is they're working very close together, the workers,
right?
In buildings that don't have windows. They're chilled to keep the meat from rotting, and the coronavirus does very well in colder weather. And they're working 2 feet from each other, and if an employee wants time off to go to the washroom, they have to, it's so loud in these slaughterhouses that they have to put their mouth to the foreman's ear. So people are in very, very close contact. And you really have, within a pandemic, an epidemic of virus infection in the meat slaughtering houses. And Trump is once again showing that he's going to force people to risk dying in order for him to say that he's reopened the economy.
Well, Mark Carlin, editor, publisher of BuzzFlash, what's the title of your piece at BuzzFlash.com today? And thank you. Devastating, devastating segment here. Just, you know, it keeps getting worse. Tell us how to get a hold of you, Mark Carlin.
You can go to @BuzzFlash on Twitter. We have a group that people can become a part of on Facebook called BuzzFlash Nation, or they could like BuzzFlash. And, of course, they can, on the Internet, put in the URL, www.buzzflash.com.
All right. Thank you so much, Mark. We'll have you back on a regular basis. Appreciate your commentary. Thank you for running that satire from Thomas Paine and for your own great work. And keep up the good work. If you want to listen in to the coming segment on this Michael Moore film, you're more than welcome to stay on the line.
I'm going to do that, Harvey. I'm very interested. I've read about criticism, and I haven't seen the film, so I'm going to listen because I'm interested in...
All right. Well, we're joined by Joel Siegel, who's a frequent guest on our show. Joel worked with Michael Moore on one of the movies he made called Sicko. Every movie by Michael Moore I've seen to date until this one I've liked. This is a horrific stab in the back to the renewable energy industry and to the people who are trying to save the planet by converting from fossil fuels and nuclear power, what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, to a solartopian energy economy. And we're also joined by the great Mark Jacobson. Mark, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
I'm here.
Okay, Mark Jacobson and Joel Siegel. Mark, tell us who you are, because I don't want to start describing your credentials. It'll take the rest of the show. So what's really important for us to know about you?
Well, I work at Stanford University as a professor, and I study climate, air pollution, and clean renewable energy solutions to those problems. And we've been developing roadmaps for countries, states, and cities for the last 10 years to transition to 100% clean renewable energy for all energy sectors.
And good for you. And you've been doing this a long time. I mean, you're one of the you and Amy Levins and a few small handful of people are really the leading experts in the world. And I'll probably have Amory on the show next week. And you're welcome to come back to join Amory Levins next week. Joel Siegel, you've been a close confidant of Michael Moore for many, many years. You worked on one of his other films. You saw this film, Humans Today. Mark Jacobson, I don't know if you've seen it, it is I can't describe it fully on air because we don't use certain words, but Joel Siegel, tell us about this film and what your impressions are and what you think it's going to how the challenges it's going to pose to the solartopian movement.
Look, Harvey, thank you, as always, for having me on, and also having Professor Mark Jacobson, who's my friend, colleague, and who in Congress I saw him testify on why we got to go to 100% clean renewable energy. I immediately said, I got to meet this guy, and he's soon going to be doing town hall meetings on Zoom, both in Congress and governors across the country that I'm putting together. So I'm just honored to be with Mark Jacobson, who he is the world's leading expert on how to transition to 100% clean renewable energy. He's been my teacher and mentor. When I worked in Congress for Congressman John Conyers between the years of 2000 and 2013, Representative Conyers told me that Michael Moore was doing a movie on health care. We, at the time, were leading the effort on both universal health care, which later became Obamacare, and single-payer Medicare for All, which Bernie Sanders, of course, has made so popular. And so I called Michael Moore's people, And I pitched the idea of SICKO to them, saying, you know, we're really losing badly in Congress on universal health care, and we need to humanize it and get stories, you know, in the movie theater so people could really see the tragedy of the uninsured. Most members of Congress were insured and their staff. And anyway, I worked with Michael for, I guess, the 8 months on the movie. He invited me to screen it with him, you know, actually to, you know, work with him on the movie, on the Capitol, right there on Capitol Hill. And then he screened the movie in Congress. I brought him into Congress, and then we screened it in D.C. And I really became very close to him. And so I was the senior technical consultant with Michael. And he's always been very, very, you know, easy to work with, very professional. He always relied on experts. This movie is a departure from the way Michael Moore has done movies in the past. You know, all of them actually were really spot on. My problem with this documentary is pretty easy. I felt like he did not, in the movie, he didn't interview people like Mark Jacobson or Professor Michael Mann or Lovins. He did. I don't know who these people were. I've never read any of their books. I've never seen them on video. I just don't know who they were. The problem with the movie, short and simple, is it really made renewable energy and clean renewable energy out to be kind of an impossible thing to achieve, that you'd have to burn fossil fuels in order to actually use, you know, clean renewable energy like solar and wind. And Mark Jacobson can explain why that's not the case, because he is the engineer. I'm not an engineer. That was a really false, dangerous narrative, okay? Number two, the good part...
Somebody's phone is ringing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The movie was pretty accurate about biomass and ethanol, and that, you know, it gives off CO2 and wood chips being very dangerous, that you can't use natural gas as a bridge fuel because of its release of methane. That was okay. The problems with, you know, oil, gas, coal, whatever, that was pretty good. But unfortunately, there was also a conspiratorial aspect of the movie where heroes like, you know, Bill McKibben of 350.org was somehow on the take with major donors who were influencing him adversely on using biofuels, et cetera. But, that, you know, his views changed 15 years ago. From 15 years ago, he's not for burning wood chips. I've worked with him before. I mean, he's a genius and a hero. All that being said, I think what Michael Moore needs to do is shut this down, apologize, and say, you know, he's learned a lot. He needs to talk to Professor Jacobson. He needs to talk to him. Then there needs to be a movie on, I think, Mark Jacobson's 50-state vision and world vision of how to rapidly transition to 100% clean, renewable energy. I hope that there's a movie done on his vision, which would be much better than the vision in that movie. Thanks.
Okay, Mark Jacobson, professor of renewable energy at Stanford, one of the world's leading experts on the transition to a solartopian economy. What do you think?
Yeah, so I saw the movie, and as Joel and you said, there's a lot of misinformation. But in particular, half the movie was on biofuels and biomass and other types of bioenergy, and they are not even part of a 100% clean renewable energy solution in any case. So I'd say half the movie right away is irrelevant because the Green New Deal, for example, which is based substantially on our roadmaps to go to 100% clean renewable energy, actually doesn't even call for the use of biofuels or biomass or bioenergy, and we certainly don't in our roadmaps to go to 100% any country of the world because of the air pollution, because of the land use, because of the water requirements, because of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with biofuels and biomass. Now, another issue is they kept harping on, well, you need materials and mining to build solar panels and wind turbines. Well, of course you do. But there's a big difference between the one-time mining for solar panels and wind turbines versus when you look at a fossil fuel, you not only need that one-time mining for the natural gas power plant and coal plant, but you need continuous mining forever of the fossil fuel themselves. And for example, in the United States alone, there are 50,000 new oil and gas wells drilled every year. And right now, there are about 1.3 million active oil and gas wells in the U.S. and 3.3 million inactive oil and gas wells. And you need to drill 50,000 new ones every year. And so they are totally exaggerating the mining impacts of one-time mining for a solar panel, which could last up to 30 years or more, or a wind turbine, which is similar. You do that once, and those components can be recycled largely, versus that continuous mining for fossil fuels. And another piece of misinformation in that movie was they were saying, well, when you shut down a coal plant, they just replace it with gas. Well, that's just not true. In the United States in 2019, for example, 72% of all new electric power capacity was renewable energy, so that means less than 28% was from natural gas. So really, the renewables are replacing coal for the most part, and gas is only a smaller amount, and eventually that will be phased out. They also say that, well, Germany is putting a lot of effort into renewables, but it didn't have much to show for it. Well, in fact, the first 3 months of 2020, 52% of all Germany's electricity was from renewable energy, and that's just growing and growing more and more. There's just another thing where they said, well, if you have one wind turbine, sometimes the wind doesn't blow, and therefore you need fossil fuels on the grid to back up the wind turbine. Well, that's just not true either. I mean, first of all, you don't just have one wind turbine. You have multiple wind turbines that are spread over geographic distance, sometimes multiple wind farms. And when you interconnect geographically dispersed wind, you actually smooth out the overall power supply, and so you actually never get any hours where you have zero power anytime during the year over, let's say, 19 wind farms over the size of one state. Now, then you add on top of that solar, which solar and wind are complementary in nature, such that during the day, when the sun is not shining, often the wind is blowing and vice versa. So you add solar into the mix and you even smooth out the grid even further. And then what do you do for backup? Well, when you have renewables, you have, for example, hydroelectric power is backup. It's much better than gas for backup because it ramps up faster. There are concentrated solar powers, storage for electricity backup. There's pumped hydroelectric storage as well. There are batteries, there are flywheels, there's compressed air energy storage. There's now gravitational mass storage with gravitational masses. And also there's heat storage in underground rocks, in underground soil, and in aquifers, and in water pits. There's cold storage in ice and in water. And we also need hydrogen and there's hydrogen storage. So there's all sorts of storage that we use for backup of the energy system with 100% clean renewable energy and storage. And in fact, we've done plans for 143 countries and tested the grid stability in those 143 countries, grouped into 24 world regions. For 3 years, we tested it and found that we can keep the grid stable every 30 seconds for all 3 years in every single one of these countries and all these world regions with just wind and water and solar on the grid and nothing else. So basically, there's very little that's actually true in this Michael Moore movie.
It's shocking to me. It's outrageous. How poorly done this movie was, and these two guys who nobody knows, Jeff and Ozzy. It's like watching Ozzy Osbourne talk about ancient Greek history. This is ridiculous. So there are four basic points in this movie. The first was that we're vastly over-consuming, and it's grotesque. And that he could have made a movie about that. And I watched Michael testify at a media interview, and he gave an absolutely beautiful rap, about 10 minutes, about overconsumption and leading us down to the path of destruction. And it was brilliant and had absolutely nothing to do with the movie. You know, the first couple of minutes, they're talking about overconsumption and how we're going to self-destruct. And the rest of the movie had nothing to do with that. And a big part of it, and this is the point I want to make before we go back to energy, was talking about overpopulation and, the rise of population. And they drew on many credible sources. People have been writing about this for 50 years, and there's certainly a case to be made that there are more people than the planet might be able to handle. I never want to say too many people because we know where that leads. there is a solution to the rise of the rapid rise of population growth, and it's very, very simple, and it's known, and it works, and it's and it is called the empowerment of women. When women are empowered, when women have access to reproductive rights, when they have access to education, when they have access to income, and they have their freedom, population plummets. Now, this has been shown repeatedly. And, you know, so in this whole hand-wringing about, oh, you know, we're overpopulating and too many people and blah, 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 which we've all heard before and which certainly has a string of credibility, they never once mentioned the one organization that has effectively fought overpopulation for 100 years and which needs our support, and that's Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood educates women. It safeguards their rights. It guarantees them medical. It guarantees them control of their own bodies. The single cause, most reliable cause, most devastating cause of overpopulation, if that's what it is male domination. And the single clearest solution is matriarchy. So they go through this whole rigmarole and song and dance. It's a very depressing, and meant to be very depressing, to do this whole thing about overpopulation. They never once talk about a solution. They never once mention birth control. They never once mention Planned Parenthood. It's ridiculous. It's insulting, obscene. And they should be ashamed of themselves just for that part. So then we get into biofuels. And, Mark, you are a leading expert on biofuels, and Joel, I'm sure you know a bit. One thing they didn't talk about, and this is a shot in the dark. You know, lawyers never ask a question that they don't know the answer, but I don't know the answer to this, Mark, and Mark Jacobson. In terms of biofuels, what is the possibility of using hemp?
Well, I mean, the issue with biofuels is that whatever it is, whether it's hemp or ethanol or woody biomass, is it takes energy to produce or process the biofuel. It takes, in the case of like ethanol, it takes energy to grow it, to fertilize it, to water it, and then actually to convert the material into a fuel. And so there's a lot of energy that goes into it. Then you're going to burn it just like you do gasoline in the end. And when you burn any fuel, whether it's a biofuel or a fossil fuel, you get air pollution. So this is why we don't even include this. But the major point is, you know, anything that you grow, photosynthesis is only 1% efficient. In other words, 1% of sunlight hitting a given area of crop actually goes to provide energy for the crop, whereas solar panels are 20% efficient. In other words, 20% of the electricity of the sunlight hitting a solar panel gets converted to electricity. So you can, no matter what the biofuel is, you can put you can get 20 times more energy for the same land area with solar panels than you can with the biofuel. Or conversely, you need 20 times more land than you do for one solar panel to get the same same energy. And so there's no benefit whatsoever of a biofuel compared to a solar panel. No matter what it is, whether it's hemp or anything else, in terms of just energy output for land input. But that's, you know, then there's no air pollution from the solar panels. Where there's air pollution when you burn the biofuel, you don't need to water the solar panel. Usually you have to water some crop. So anyway, yeah, biofuels and biofuels in general are just not solutions.
Yes, and this film does a pretty significant job. Of course, they don't talk to any experts. They just, you know, rant on about this and that. The reason I was interested in hemp, aside from being interested in hemp all these years, is that with the boom of CBD, you wonder, a hemp plant is big. And hemp does not really require fertilizer or pesticides or herbicides. I mean, hemp really just grows. It will outgrow any weed. I mean, maybe that's why they call it weed, for God's sakes. And with the boom of the CBD industry, which is not going away, I mean, it's a huge industry. You wonder what's happening to the rest of the plant. It could be fermented, I suppose, but then that has to be burnt. So it's the one thing about biofuels that I remain interested in. And we can move on from that. And maybe you can refer me at some point to some reports that would talk about that. But clearly, CBD has come on the scene. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry now, and or getting there. Let's put it that way. It will be, and you wonder about the rest of the plant. So let's move on now. And Joel Siegel, feel free, or Mark Carlin, if you want, to jump in at any point. But this film did an incredible hatchet job on photovoltaic cells. And if I remember right, and maybe Joel, you've seen it just today, I don't remember them showing rooftop solar panels. This was all about panels being deployed into vacant fields and into the desert. And also, of course, the power tower technology, where you have mirrors surrounding a tower that then gets into molten salt. But I don't remember them. I don't remember seeing a single rooftop panel. Do you remember them in there, in the film?
They did not. Yeah, that was one of the first questions I had. Like, why aren't they talking about rooftop solar panel? You know, in China, they're literally floating, you know, panels on the ocean and rivers. And this is becoming more and more popular. And as Professor Jacobson has been saying for years, the price of solar, you know, panels keeps going down, right? And they didn't also talk about geothermal. They didn't talk about tidal energy or wave energy. But they also missed the point that, and I heard this over and over again in the movie, that, you know, hey, look, the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining, and therefore, you know, you can't rely on 100% clean, renewable energy. Well, that's why you have battery storage systems that Professor Jacobson has been talking about for years. You store the excess energy in batteries. And in Australia, they have this gigantic, you know, few acres of battery storage, and they failed to mention that. And even with wind energy, they didn't go into offshore wind either. I don't remember them going. In North Carolina, you could literally power the state of North Carolina's electric utility needs just by offshore wind energy alone, and they did not go into offshore wind energy. And then also, you know, in the Pacific Ocean, which is deeper, it used to be very problematic to figure out, okay, how you get wind energy deep water. Well, now they've even changed the technology for that. So it was just, I still don't understand how they could have missed that, and why Michael didn't talk to people like Jacobson or Michael Mann or other, or even Al. Al Gore could have really gone into that as well.
They really trashed Al Gore, and I find that somewhat satisfying. But I got some issues with Al Gore. But they did the classic bushwhack journalist thing, which is they were at the big march on climate, and they had like a 30-second shot at Bobby Kennedy, who, here's the couple guys with a camera, and they come at him, and they ask him what he thinks about biofuels. I mean, you know, this is in the middle of a march, for God's sakes. And I got to say, you know, people have issues with Bobby. I know Bobby Kennedy, and I like him a lot, and they have issues. He opposed a wind farm off Cape Cod, basically for scenic reasons. People are really mad at that. He's got this whole vaccination thing. But Bobby Kennedy was really helped birth the movement against factory farms. And if these guys really wanted to get into pollution and the destruction of the future of Earth, you know, they might have started with factory farming. But Mark Jacobson, let's talk about the treatment of wind power in this film, and where is wind power actually going in the world, and then we'll go to solar panels.
Well, I mean, there's enough wind in the world to power the entire world for all purposes about seven times over, and that's at low cost. In the movie, they're dismissing, like the energy and materials that go into a wind turbine, but they completely neglect to say that, the energy payback time of a wind turbine is about 3 months. So in other words, of all the fossil fuel energy that's needed to produce a wind turbine today, and of course, if you have 100% renewable energy world, you won't need any fossil fuel to produce a wind turbine. It's all be from renewables. But today, it's about 3 months of running a wind turbine. The energy from running a wind turbine for 3 months is how much fossil fuel energy goes in it. But a turbine will last 30 years. And so that means it's 99% emission free. And you know, all those materials are really, you know, trivial compared with the amount of energy it produces, which, you know, with a coal plant, you know, you're continuously emitting fossil fuels through the whole life, in addition to emitting fossil fuels by building the coal plant itself. So it's just all relative things. That, you know, they just exaggerate things by not, they just show some absolute numbers or absolute or some specific cases without actually looking relatively at how much better wind and solar are to fossil fuels. They completely ignore all the problems with fossil fuels and just focus on certain negative things about wind turbines and solar panels that are really trivial in comparison to their benefits. I mean, the major benefit of wind and solar is they have zero emissions during their life. So that worldwide, that saves 7 million lives per year. 7 million people die from air pollution every year from fossil fuel and biofuel combustion. And those lives are all saved when you go to clean renewable energy because we have no more emissions in the limit of 100% renewables. Especially when we get to 100%, as I said, all wind turbines and solar panels will be built with renewable energy. And then we eliminate the climate problem, and we lower energy costs. I mean, by going to renewables and electrifying everything, we reduce energy requirements 57%. We reduce energy costs 60%, and we reduce energy plus health plus climate costs 90%. So that's called the social cost benefit of clean renewable energy. It's 90% reduction of social costs on the annual basis. And 60% reduction of energy costs. We also create 28 million more jobs than lost. These are long-term full-time jobs than are lost worldwide, and about 3 million in the U.S. So we create jobs, we reduce air pollution, health problems, we reduce climate problems, we reduce the cost of energy. What is there not to like about that compared to the fossil fuel system we have today?
Well, I was shocked, actually. They did not trot out the usual number one argument against wind power, which is bird kills from the turbines. My understanding is that the industrial-sized turbines, and they, you know, they're really big now. I mean, I've seen the average new industrial turbine is probably 2.5 megawatts or thereabout, which is huge. I mean, it takes a really suicidal bird to fly into one of those big wind towers now. And the most recent study I saw was that the large commercial utility-scale windmills kill an average of one bird a year. Have you seen similar numbers, Mark?
Well, the Fish and Wildlife Service, for example, says that all wind turbines in the U.S. kill maybe, I think it was like 600,000 birds a year, which sounds like a lot. Well, yeah, but they, you know, if you look at the American Bird Conservancy and the Wildlife Service, you know, they say that communication towers kill 10 to 50 million birds per year. Buildings kill 1 billion birds per year, and cats kill 3 billion birds per year in the United States alone. So it's just trivial, the number of birds killed by wind turbines versus all these other sources. But what's more relevant, you know, wind turbines kill one-tenth the number of birds compared with coal or gas plants, because coal kills birds in three ways, from the air pollution, from the mining, and the destruction of the land habitat, and from the buildings themselves. And same with natural gas. So, you know, wind turbines reduce bird kills compared to the current fossil fuel infrastructure. That's really the way that's the accurate way to report it from those who are critical of wind turbines.
Joel, you want to jump in on windmills, or should we move to solar panels? Joel Siegel?
Yeah, I mean, what you know, Professor Jacobs, when I listen to him, he never speaks from notes. It's kind of amazing to listen to him. I'm a policy analyst myself. It's just incredible memory and expertise on this issue is mind-blowing. Well, I mean, in terms of the birds, are they going to outlaw hunting? Like, I live in North Carolina, where everybody, you know, a lot of people kill birds. So, are they going to – I've never heard anyone talk about, well, let's just outlaw hunting and stop the killing of birds. But there also – there's new technology in terms of the wind turbines – so that they do reduce birds that are actually, you know, killed. That's number one. But, we don't have the other alternative but wind and solar. That's it. I mean, we got about 10 years to get off of fossil fuels, 10 years.
At most.
We have to
reduce. That's optimistic.
Let's just say at least by 80%, we have to be 80% there within 10 years of not using fossil fuel, using clean renewable energy in all energy sectors, certainly the majority by 2045 or sooner, and that's all there is to it. That's what the world's climate scientists are saying, and I would just pose this question. If not solar and wind, then what? Thanks.
Oh, I have the perfect solution. What you do is you take Donald Trump and you put him in one of those round cages for hamsters, and then you run him constantly. That'll generate the electricity we need. So, Mark, offhand, can you tell us how many utility-scale windmills are there in the United States? What's the average size?
Right now in the U.S., I think they're around 60,000, but a lot of them are smaller, older ones still. But I'd say the average size is maybe 1.5 megawatts. Now there are wind turbines being built that are 12 megawatts.
Really? 12? God, that must be enormous. That's enormous. Of course, their efficiency has accelerated, so you don't have to make them as big as once envisioned. I will tell you, I was at the original Toward Tomorrow Fair in Amherst, Massachusetts in 1975 with Amory Lovins, who remains a good friend, and William Hieronymus, who passed away. And Hieronymus was talking about 5 megawatt offshore wind turbines that were floating. In other words, they're not anchored to the ocean floor, and everybody thought he was completely nuts. And, of course, that's way been transcended already, right?
Oh, yeah. There are now floating offshore wind turbines that have been deployed, and that's really the mecca for energy in the world because there's so much offshore wind, especially far offshore where people don't have to see it. And that's like there's a system, especially in the United States off the East Coast and the West Coast, there's just a huge surplus of offshore wind that can be captured. But we only have literally two wind farms in the whole U.S., two wind turbines offshore in the whole U.S. right now.
Right, but the Scandinavian countries have jumped ahead, as has Germany. Let's talk about Germany for a minute. How effective, Mark Jacobson, has been the transition to renewables in Germany? You always hear this garbage about how they haven't lowered emissions and blah, blah, blah. What's really going on in Germany?
Well, it's been ramping up. It's been creeping up and up and up. And this year, the first 3 months, 52% of all electric power in Germany was from renewables. Now, people say, well, overall CO2 hasn't declined very much. Well, part of the reason is that Germany is actually exporting more electricity now. It's producing so much that there's more exports and there's more demand for exports. And so some of that's due to the fact that they're actually producing more to export more electricity to other countries. So when you actually look at just what Germany is using, there is a substantial, moderate, modest reduction of overall carbon dioxide. But in the electric power sector alone, there's a huge reduction because it's been transitioned to clean renewable energy. The other sectors haven't been transitioned, and so that's where most of the remaining emissions are from.
Now, a lot of the transition in Germany, and by the way, they're going to close the last nuclear plant in 2022, and we need to celebrate this month. Just around now, they're setting the Indian Point nuclear plant north in New York City. It's one great thing that Andrew Cuomo has done. Unit 2 is going to shut this year and Unit 3 this week. And Unit 3 next year, and then Indian Point will be done. He has subsidized 4 reactors upstate, which is absolutely insane, but we won't get into that. So the question then becomes rooftop solar, Mark Jacobson. I have a house with limited roof space, so I'm waiting until the solar panels hit 1,000 kilowatts. How long am I going to have to wait?
Have 1,000 kilowatts?
I want a single panel to be 1,000 kilowatts. That way, a house which wants maybe – I assume the average house in the U.S. wants about 5,000 kilowatts, right, of capacity.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, you could just combine, two or three smaller ones. But to have one panel 1,000 kilowatts, there might not be much of a demand. I'm sure you could find one. It's just they're not mass-produced, so –
So how effective now is rooftop solar? which was never mentioned in this film. It's unbelievable. Rooftop solar is the core of the transition in the United States to renewable energy. They never mentioned rooftop solar in the whole show.
Well, the biggest benefit of it is that you can put it up really fast. I mean, you can put up rooftop solar in 6 months, and you're generating electricity displacing fossil fuels. Even a utility-scale solar, that often you get, you know, all the permitting that needs anywhere from 1.5 to 2 or 3 years. But, I mean, that's not too bad. But also, you don't need transmission lines so much for rooftop solar, if, you know, especially for the portion that's used in your own home. And whereas large-scale utility solar, you do need transmission lines. But, you know, the advantage of large-scale utility solar is the economies of scale. You can put huge numbers of panels, and so the price per panel drops significantly. Rooftop solar, you can do the same thing if you do multiple homes at the same time, contract them at the same time, or if you do it on large buildings, like industrial-scale buildings, then you can get economies of scale. And so that's actually, you know, probably the most efficient types of solar is you take an industrial flat roof, a huge roof, and you put solar panels on it. Then you minimize transmission, and you don't use new land area, and you have, you know, various local source of solar PV. So you will need to transition everything. You will need both rooftop solar and utility scale solar, as well as wind and, you know, other electric sources and storage.
Well, in the film, they showed from the air, I think the battery factory in Nevada. The super factory there, and the gigafactory, and it did not have solar panels on it, and now it does, is my understanding.
Right.
And they showed the roof without solar panels, but it now has them on it.
Yeah, well, the goal was
right?
to have 100% renewable electricity, and when it was built, of course, it didn't have it, but now it is.
Yeah, I wonder if the panels went on before or after they finished editing this film. It's outrageous. So
yeah.
The other question they didn't raise in the film, which I'm sure they would have if they thought of it, are there any proven health effects from having to people in the house or in the factory when you have solar panels on the roof?
No, there are no health effects whatsoever. I mean, there's only a benefit if you're in a hot climate. The solar panels will cool the house a little bit because they take out 20% of the solar energy and convert it to electricity sent to the house or the grid, so you get a little cooling, but there are no chemicals that are, you know, emanating from the solar panels that are going to get.
Well, what about microwaves? You know, electrical waves.
No, that's. I mean, you know, first of all, you have the solar panels on top of a roof, and so you're separated by a roof, and then your roof is separated from you by several feet. But even so, that's just not. You know, there's no more issues compared with just having a normal electricity in your home.
Okay, so we don't want to be blindsided by that. I don't want to 20 years from now hear that all the panels have to come off because they're doing what people say 5G is doing, which is a whole other issue. You know, there are people out there linking 5G to the coronavirus. It's an interesting discussion, let's put it that way, but we don't want to have that if there's no. I was told that the reason there's no health impact from solar panels on a roof is because it's DC as opposed to AC. And the implication being if it was AC, alternating current as opposed to direct current, it would have a health impact.
Yeah. Well, I've had solar rooftop solar for 15 years, and I've never experienced any problem.
Well, thankfully, we're glad to hear that. So despite this film, it will hurt us. It's a diversion. Another diversion coming from an unexpected and unwanted source. And it does revive the discussion. I'm sure Donald Trump will go see it and tell us how much he liked it. But what is the future of wind and solar in the United States, Mark Jacobson?
Well, I think the future is bright because we need to transition away from fossil fuels. And the only practical solution is transition to wind, solar, and some water. So we will do it. And we're also seeing that there, you know, they said 72% of all new electric power capacity in the United States last year was from wind and solar and other renewables. And it's only going to go up. So I think the future is very bright, regardless of this film.
Joel Siegel?
Yes, Harvey.
Yes. So you, and being in the legislative branch, you're going to have to do this without the help of the government. That's obvious. But listen, we're almost at the end here. Mark Jacobson, how do people get a hold of you? Oh, my God, we're done. Mark, I hope you and Joel can come back. Mark Carlin, thank you for your great commentary at the top. We're going to go to Solartopia. That's what this show is all about. And we'll get there. I hope Michael Moore will apologize and join us on the trek. Thank you, crew in New York. We'll see you next week in the Green Power and Wellness Show in Solartopia. Thank you.
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost.